Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's the changing of the guard, and the guard is changing because the season is changing throughout Alabama. I think you could call it different things in different places. In South Alabama, I think you would probably call it American summer. You still want to call this spring in South Alabama when you've got temperatures in the 80s every day? But it's clearly not that thing we have called Gulf summer. Gulf summer comes along about June 15th, and what's going to happen is the temperature is going to be 80 degrees at night, at least on a lot of days. It's a very different season, Gulf summer. Now there's a good bit of difference. 10 to 15 degrees at least, often 20 degrees difference in day and night temperatures over this season, and that's neat, and that's actually good for a lot of plants. They actually do better with that kind of difference in day and night temperature, particularly as temperatures get really high. When they get really high. So it's a changing. The birds are changing. So we've lost, I think the whole state has finally lost the white pelicans. And I am always sorry to see them go. They've moved out of South Alabama probably pretty early on. They kind of move in stages throughout the state, and I think they disappeared even from the northern reaches. Those are gone. You know what else you're going to notice? In South Alabama, you're going to notice all those hummingbirds. I'm fixing to get calls about it, I know. All those hummingbirds that you were so excited about in March, early April, they're all going to disappear. It's going to scare everybody to death. My mother, she's going to call me again. She does every spring, and she says, I don't know what the power company's doing to those hummingbirds. The hummingbirds leave. They're going in. They're going into the interior. They're nesting. Now, in North Alabama, it may be a little bit different, but you're going to see far fewer hummingbirds, particularly in South Alabama, over the next several weeks, because they're going into the interior, they're nesting. I don't know whether the hummingbirds I think they're smart enough to move well into the interior to do nesting. So they're probably, maybe those hummingbirds that were around Mobile, I think somebody ought to test this. Somebody ought to track this. My suspicion is they're probably way up now, maybe in Monroe County and Clark County for the most part, maybe all the way up Montauk County, maybe all the way up in North Alabama. But wherever you are in the state, you're going to see less of them because they're probably in the woods. They're probably in areas where they're raising a new generation. So they're going to be spending a lot of time doing that. Less time entertaining you at your feeders. And kind of interesting to know. I'm glad that they ignore your feeders this time of year because they have important business to do, which is to develop a new generation of youngins, which they're going to be busy doing. It's always a disappearing act. The hummingbirds are gone. But, a lot of other things are beginning to come in. And particularly even on the coast, we're beginning to see a lot of those shorebirds that we haven't seen as much of this time of year. earlier in the year. They're going to be coming up this time of year. The full-fledged, symphony of birdsong is now happening in North Alabama, Birmingham, and Huntsville. All these things, it's a signal that the seasons are changing. You may be lucky enough. I hope you're lucky enough to hear a whippoorwill or a southern whippoorwill, which has a very different sound, but is also my favorite whippoorwill sound. Those things are beginning to happen. So it's a big changing. It's a signal to you that things are going to be changing in your garden. The end of winter greens over most of the area. Northernmost Alabama may be able to hold on to some of those winter greens for a little while longer without them getting eaten up by bugs or it getting too hot to really enjoy them. But, you know, collards is not a year-round thing in most of Alabama. In case you didn't know that, it's a cool weather crop. It's a cool weather crop. We have many other greens for summer. Maybe we ought to talk about what some of those other summer greens are, and we will. Maybe that's going to be a subject for today's show. We've got the beginning of summer. It really is the first of two or three summers, really, that happen on the Gulf Coast. If you want to see it in Huntsville, it's the last summer-like stage of spring, the most summer-like stage of spring in Huntsville. I don't have a good name for it yet, but we're going to think of one. Very different season in both ends of the state, but both are in this transition. If you're in South Alabama, you ought to hold on to your tomatoes. You missed it. You just missed it if you haven't planted them already. Don't worry about planting them now. Come back and plant those tomatoes a little bit later. A little bit later, maybe around 1st of June, would be a good time to begin thinking about planting your tomatoes on the Gulf Coast if you missed the prime opportunity in late February, early March, particularly if you're down right on the margin of the water. But okra, eggplants, peas, butter beans, basil, all these are great summer crops that you can still be planting. And in fact, there's really not much need to plant a lot of those before this time of year. They really want those night temperatures to begin getting a lot warmer. So it's a transition time for flowers. You know, it's too late for marigolds, really. If you're in the southern part of the state, it's getting to be too late for marigolds, even in the northern part of the state, to begin planting them out because of those humid summer days, which the marigolds don't like nearly as much. But things like tithonias, they weather this well. It's a great time to plant them. It's a great time for a lot of our native plants. It's a great time to begin thinking about getting your hibiscus ready for a full-fledged show in the middle of summer, because the middle of summer is a different time. What you enjoy now, like the marigolds, like even a lot of the perennials like echinacea, like coneflowers, they're the result of stuff you did in anticipating this season several months ago. It's too late for them now. Let's move on. Let's move on to American summer. That's what we're going to talk more about. Oh, you know, I also got to say, just on the list of things to remind you about, not that it's the most important thing and not that I care a whole lot, except that I'm obliged to tell you a little bit about this so that you don't, because I'll have to answer questions about it if I don't. Raise your mower. It's time to raise the lawnmower. If you want to have fewer problems with your grass, you could goof around, you could do all kind of goofy things with your lawnmower during the onset of spring because that grass is going to be coming on anyway. You could have cut it really short and it would probably have survived. But now, with these higher temperatures coming on, slowly start raising your lawnmower. You got any questions about that? You give me a call. It's the changing of seasons. We could talk about it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about what you could be doing, what you should be doing, what it's probably not useful to be doing right now, give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Not going to comment.
I got it out of the way early.
Yeah. So let's go from that sound to a much nicer sound. So Keith in Agricola is telling me that the whippoorwills, are all over and that they're very loud. Keith, so, you know, there's two sounds. There's and then there's this other sound. Those are the two different sounds. I actually like the second sound a little better. And tell me, Keith, which one you think it is. Is it that first sound? Or is it? Tell me what you think. I hope that wasn't too loud. Surely it got buffered in all that wire between us all. But tell me what you think it is. So the second call is the southern whippoorwill. We ought to have a better name for it. It's a different species. And I always like to say that I think it's the southern whippoorwill that I heard a lonesome whippoorwill. I think that's got to be the one. Because that would have been what he would have been hearing around Greenville. All right. Hummingbirds showing up in Wilcox County around April 2nd. You know, one of the ways to know when hummingbirds are going to be showing up in your yard and in your garden is to look at when the buckeyes bloom in your area. And this is really interesting. So, and hummingbirds really go for those buckeyes. It's one of the first things they look for when they're coming up. And the buckeyes, it probably timed their flowers because hummingbirds are major pollinators of buckeyes. So naturally, the buckeyes would time their flowering to coincide with the hummingbirds moving up. So it's really interesting. So on the Gulf Coast, those buckeyes are blooming what? I've seen them bloom as early as February, late February, start blooming early, late February, particularly that first and maybe the second week in March, they're starting to bloom really good, the red buckeyes. And they start blooming, probably late March, early April in North Alabama, and that's when you begin to see the hummingbirds up there. It's just like, boom. Interesting sort of coordination of flowering and hummingbirds and birds as those birds move up. So it's one way to time it. Let's see here. What else have we got? This is a really interesting question, and Don is asking me this one, and I hear it a lot, and I've experimented with it myself. And the question is, how somebody used to tell you, plant your tomatoes, tear off the bottom leaves of your tomatoes and plant them really deep in the garden. Now, let me tell you right away why I think that's a wrong thing. Let me just tell you why. I'm going to suggest a slightly different way of thinking about this. So, Don, hold on. So, the reason why that's a bad idea, there are two reasons why. First is, tomatoes like warm soil. And they're going to develop roots better in warm soil. And so if you stick that tomato way down in the ground is much cooler way down there, and you're going to have a big problem with those roots developing. And you're probably going to slow the tomato down. Here's the second problem. Oxygen in the soil declines, particularly in southern soils, particularly in a lot of soils we have, unless you have really perfect soils. It begins to decline as the plant goes, as the roots go down. And oxygen is very important for those roots to operate. And so a lot of times if you plant too deep, those roots down below are going to basically die off. They're not going to develop very well. So what you've done is you've traded off the roots that are in the bottom of the pot, which are really pretty significant, and you said, okay, I don't care about those. I just want new roots on the top. Well, that doesn't make any sense. What you'd really rather have is roots in both places. So for tomatoes, this is just for tomatoes, and I'm not suggesting if you're in South Alabama that you plant your tomatoes now. You're going to hold off. But for tomatoes, what I might do, if you feel like the roots in the container are not as well developed as they should be, they may be, they may not be, lay the plant on its side. Just kind of put it at an angle. You see what I'm saying? You're not planting it too deep. You're allowing it to develop some roots. A little higher on the stem, that's all fine. But the plant is there and it's closer to the surface, and things are going to develop much better. Plant it at an angle. Pretty strong angle, actually, if you like. It'd be fine. Now, peppers are different. And I have played with peppers a lot. Because when I'm growing tomatoes, listen to me, when I'm growing tomatoes in a container, container growth is very different than it is in the ground, obviously, because oxygen is freely available in a container. It's all circulating around the container. It's not usually limiting. The container is going to be about as warm at the top as it is at the bottom, so temperature is not an issue. And so a lot of times I like to start the tomatoes in a little bit of soil in a container and build that soil up around the tomato, and sure enough, it will keep producing roots. And so I get a stronger root system when I'm ready to transplant it out. Seems to work pretty well. There's some other advantages to that in a container. It also seems to reduce the incidence of damping off for several reasons, and it helps to sturdy up and thicken the stem on plants that are grown inside. It just has a lot of advantages. But it's not true when you're doing that in regular soil. It doesn't work that way in regular soil. I tried the same thing with peppers in a container, and peppers just don't like putting on new roots on the stem. I think they do it, but not quickly and not readily. So there's not a lot of advantage to doing that. In fact, peppers are funny. They don't have a lot of root system to begin with, and it's always a problem with peppers. They seem to be really slow to get their root system started. But I don't think there's any way you can get them to develop a significant number of roots while they're still in the container, and I don't think, for the same reasons I discussed with tomatoes, I don't think there's any reason to putting those peppers deep in the ground so that they develop roots on the stems. So I'm trying to explain why, but let me go back and say, no, don't plant your tomatoes deeper than they are in the pot. When you take them out of the container, that's the size you got. You got to go with it. And you just got to go with what's there. Don't plant those peppers any deeper. They really resent cold soil. They really hate cold soil. So you want those pepper roots to be as close to the surface as they can be, right? So don't plant them too deep. You can plant your tomatoes at an angle, but do not plant them too deep in the soil. That's not the goal here. In fact, planting stuff deep this time of year, and particularly in spring when you're trying to plant tomatoes and the ground is still cool, you see what I'm saying? Don't plant them too deep. It just doesn't work. In summer, you might enjoy the cooler soil underneath for the tomatoes, but by then, your soil is compacted. It's got lots of other problems. If you're on the Gulf Coast, you're approaching Gulf summer, when the ground is going to be very wet, there's just never a reason to plant those tomatoes overly deep once you get them in the ground. Does that all make sense? Does that all make sense? Let's see here. What else we got? Don is seeing the southern whippoorwills. That's great. It really is great to hear them. You know, to hear them, let me just remind folks, these are sounds at night. So when Hank, when good old Hank was out there hearing them at night, I heard a lonely whippoorwill calling out my name. He was leaving a bar in Greenville, I can tell you. Probably playing some bar in Greenville. And he heard that lonesome whippoorwill. And it was in the evening. It was night. It was late. Oftentimes it's around 1 or 2 o'clock at night when you hear these things. So you got to leave your window open if you're going to hear them, right? We're going to be back here in just a minute.
I ain't gonna pick no peace because everything.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I'm going to have to look a little closer. Somebody's asking me what is taking over my yard. I can't see right now as well what that is. I'm going to try to take a little closer look. Do you think the cicadas are going to go this far south? Well, you know, how far south, this far south is... depends on where you are. This group of cicadas occurred, 11 years ago, 13 years ago, somewhere 11 years ago, I think. No, it was 13 years ago. And that was 2011. There we go. It was 13 years ago, I believe, in 2011, I remember distinctly when it happened. I don't always remember the dates, but I do remember I do remember the time of year, and it was on the verge of April and May, about this time of year, in the Red Hills. Now, if you don't know where the Red Hills are, let me tell you, it's a really interesting area. Maybe I shouldn't tell you about it. It hasn't been invaded yet by a lot of people, but it's a really interesting area of Alabama. In Monroe County, Conecuh County, Clark County, it's the hills in those areas. And I'm not sure how far over into Conecuh County it was, but I can tell you that in Clark County and Monroe County, and in particularly in Monroe County and up into Choctaw County, there were a lot of cicadas, and I heard them. And it was almost always on the edge of some of the old rich forest. You didn't see them in areas where it was lots of pine plantation. I think I understand why that is. I think basically all of that decimation of forest has a huge impact on a lot of creatures. But you would see it where there was longleaf. There would be longleaf areas where you would see that, natural longleaf areas, but not in the areas where the pine plantations, where there were dense, usually where there were dense natural forest in the Red Hills, in those areas. You will not see them in Mobile and Baldwin counties, I'm pretty sure. Even in North Baldwin County, even in North Mobile County, I guess there's a small possibility there will be some areas in North Mobile County, maybe around Citronelle, but I kind of doubt it. I think you're going to have to go up, and maybe in Washington County we'll see a little bit of it, but you're really going to have to get up to the Red Hills. Escambia County, northern part of Escambia County, northernmost Escambia County, that's where you're going to see a lot of them. You're probably also going to see a lot of them in the Tennessee Valley around Huntsville. It's pretty well documented that they show up around Madison County. Now, Madison County has done everything it can, and Limestone County is catching up to destroy everything of any natural value in those places. I don't know how many cicadas we're going to have left up there. What are the effects of it? Nothing, other than it's just super cool. It is super cool. If you're interested in eating cicadas, there's a lot more cicadas to eat. Can you eat cicadas? Yes, you can. Do they taste good? Well, I don't know, honestly. But I do know that they are quite edible. And we could talk about that maybe a little more. But these are just going to add to our normal load of cicadas. There will be a little more of them. They will sound very different. They will be very different colored. And they're kind of neat. And they disappear quickly. They come and go very quickly. It's a 2 or 3 week period. Is it going to have a major impact on your life? If you love sounds, if you love nature, it will be something you never forget. If you're completely ignorant of nature and you want to stay in your house and sit in your recliner and do whatever people do when they do that, it won't have any impact on your life at all. Zero. Silch. There it is. Cicadas. Rusty says you this great thing. Bill, FYI, he got a picture of a radish, a red rat's tail radish, and his thing is, just because you can grow it doesn't mean you should. Very fibrous, even chopped up in stir fries, not a lot of flavor, Rusty. All right, good, good. I was in Baltimore for 2 weeks, my ears rang. You mean this is back in 2011, Keith? Yeah, I think they were certainly up there. All right, what else we got? Yeah, so let me. Yeah, here we go. I'm going to. This is Don. I'm going to throw you a curveball. So I fill the lower 2 feet of my raised beds with compost. Does this, in case, create heat as it decomposes, therefore allowing the roots to maintain a tolerant temperature? In theory, yes. In practice, probably not so much. I think it would take more than compost to do that. I don't think that's going to make a lot of difference, honestly. I don't think it'll make a lot of difference. I also recommend, because let me just go back to an old kind of rule I follow. The topsoil is on top. And so it's a good idea when you're thinking about doing your garden to think about adding the topsoil material to the top. Compost, if it's done correctly, really doesn't need to be super decomposed. And if it's super decomposed, it's not giving off any heat anymore. It's not going to give off a lot of heat deep in the soil because there's not enough oxygen for that to happen. So what we really want is we always want the compost to go on top. I don't dig it in. The creatures, the soil creatures, are going to dig it in, and in that process, they're going to make your soil better. But I don't, as a matter of routine, want to put the topsoil, I don't want to turn the topsoil under, particularly deeply. You can stir it up just a little bit, I reckon, but even that's not a great idea, particularly if you're going to continue to add compost. And a lot of times I compost in place. This ain't Boston. Things are going to rot pretty easily here. And it makes a lot more sense to compost where you need it. But no, the simple answer, Don, is no. I don't think it will heat the soil up. And the reason is it doesn't have enough access to oxygen. So it's going to be limited in its ability to heat up. And bacterial decomposition is going to be limited. So no, I don't think it'll heat it up. And two, it's probably not the best way to create good soil. Topsoil's on the top. That's kind of a simple rule, and you could break it every now and then, but I'd be careful about it. Johnny in Grand Bay tells me. Johnny in Grand Bay tells me that his guard is doing well. Dwarf Blue Jay Corn is tasseling. I want to hear how this does, Johnny. It is a great experiment. Johnny has had problems with blowdown with corn before, as a lot of us have, particularly on the Gulf Coast. And when you're planting smaller groups of corn, it can be a real problem. And so he's trying this blue jade corn that's a dwarf form, and it's tasseling, and the ears are forming. So, Johnny, I'll be interested to hear how it's doing. The squash and zucchini have no pollinators right now. Well, they should. That's interesting. It's kind of a worry if they don't. But there's always a little bit of a lag, initially with when those first female flowers come on. So the male flowers come on first, almost always with squash. And, of course, the male flowers, you know, they don't make fruit. Right? Why don't they make fruit? Well, you think about it. You just think about it a little bit hard, and you'll see that the male flowers are not there to produce fruit. They're just there to produce pollen that fertilizes the female flower. The female flower is going to produce the fruit. Not all plants are like that. A lot of plants, the normal thing for plants is to have male and female on the same plant in the same flower. That's normal. That's perfect for a plant. I'm sorry, that's the way life is. But squash are a little different in that male and female flowers are on the same plant, but they're separate flowers, and the male flowers come on first, enticing those pollinators in, and then the female flowers come on, and there's always a little bit of a frustrating lag, but I think they'll come on. You should have the pollinators. If you don't have the pollinators, we've done something really bad, and I'm not saying we haven't done something really bad, but I hope things are fine. I hope things are fine, Johnny, and I think you're going to see that happening pretty soon. This beautiful grasshopper that he's got given me a picture of, just incredibly beautiful. And dewberries are looking really good. And yes, Johnny, I think that is toad flax. That is toad flax. It's a cool little thing. All right, let's see what we got here. Other questions that I haven't gotten to yet. Okay, I drilled holes in the base. The question is, if I can put it, okay, I'm trying to allow for air flow and oxygen and drainage. You know, yes, in a raised bed, you will have slightly better, airflow just because it's a raised bed. And that is good and bad. I still don't think you're going to see a lot of heating up as a result of this. For compost to heat up, it really needs to be on the surface, and it needs to be turned pretty regularly. So whatever heating impacts that compost has are probably declining. Now, I know that they used to make beds in Europe with horse manure, fresh horse manure. I think there was so much ammonia and so much heat that it actually worked. But I don't think with compost it's going to work that well. I just don't think it's going to add that much heat. Don, this voice to text thing is scary. So Don is his voice to text is actually picking my voice up on the radio and turning it into text and sending it back to me. That's scary, Don. That's just scary. There we go. All right, we're going to be back here. Beautiful lilies in Spanish Fort, as always, from Jim in Spanish Fort.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face.
Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Ha! Huh, we've got this. I've got this picture, and I'm trying to discern. Somebody's asked me, what is this plant invading my yard? And I've got a picture of the leaf. It's looking like, and I shouldn't say it because I'm not sure. It's looking like a wild cucumber. If it's going to flower here pretty soon, and when it flowers, if you can send me the flower, I can give you a little better diagnosis. The other thing I can say is, if you'll write me, if the person who has said this is taking over my yard, this yard must be in Midtown, I'm guessing. It is, if it's a vining kind of thing, let me know. It may help me to distinguish what it is. What I can tell, and I'm very suspicious, because there's a dog there, and there's a bunch of playthings around the dog, which maybe the dog or the child is playing with it. There's a lot of foot traffic and dog traffic right there. And so what's happened is, I can see the area is kind of rubbed bare, and so what's happening is the lawn has been suppressed there, and so it's allowed this other plant to come in, which is probably not going to take over your whole yard, just the areas where you're getting a lot of traffic. And it's not so much that this plant is taking over your grass as the fact that the grass has disappeared, and that's giving this plant room to move in. Send me a message if it seems connected by small vines, or if there are above ground runners that connect it. It'll help me to sort of identify what this is. We may need a flower, though, I'll have to say. All right, but what do you do about it? Well, I would say that no matter what, you're going to have to address the fact that it's getting sort of trampled out there pretty good. There's a lot of activity right there. A lot of activity right there. Looks like you got St. Augustine grass and other places. So if you succeed in killing whatever this thing is, it's no guarantee that the grass is going to grow back. You may have just mud. So let's think about that. That's probably a good place. It's another good place for something that's a little tougher, that will handle foot traffic a little better. And one of those things is monkey grass. And you can mow monkey grass, and this may be a place you want to come back with monkey grass. All right? Does that help? Okay. What else we got? I see. So somebody's sent me a picture of penstemon looking very nice. A cultivar apparently called Onyx and Pearl, blooming the first time in Silver Hill. You know, it is the time that those things begin blooming, the penstemons. They're known as summer. They're known as summer perennial. They're known as summer perennial in other parts of North America, well north of us. But they're really this sort of American summer perennial. They're going to bloom this time of year. And they're not going to bloom in summer. Not deep summer. Not July. They're going to bloom in American summer, which on the Gulf Coast is April to June. They're going to start blooming in what I sort of see as the final stage of spring around Huntsville. That's when they bloom. All right, there we go. Let's see. This beautiful Hudson and Henry. Hudson and Henry, glad you guys are doing this and paying attention. And they have a beautiful horseshoe crab shell they found. Aren't horseshoe crabs the neatest things in the whole world? I just love horseshoe crabs. That is the coolest thing. And I also see that the person who sent me the Onyx and Pearl picture had a question for me when I was out I'm sometimes out. Is it true that you have to plant Meyer's lemon seeds right out of the fruit, or can they be dried and planted? Huh. I would say that they're probably pretty rugged. The problem with Meyer's lemon seeds is I don't know that they're going to come true. I'll have to look at this. I don't know of anybody who's propagating Meyer's lemons from seeds. And the reason is that they're actually a hybrid. And I'm not sure they're going to come true. I'll look into this. So the question is not so much when you plant them as to what you're going to get when you plant them, because it might not be a true Meyer's lemon. Most Meyer's lemons are grafted. There you go. Let's see what else we got. From David, just remind for those so inclined that in the next few weeks the native black cherries will be starting to ripen. Time to start planning for this year's cherry bounce. Tam, I'm sorry, that was Tam. He was being rude. You can ignore him. So black cherry is one of the great underused fruits of the Gulf Coast and Alabama in general. Really love those black cherries. Really great wildlife food. It's a big crop, lasts for a pretty long time. The berries are out there. Birds are loving it. Birds are loving it. The berries hit the ground. Lots of other things can pick it up, including quail. It's a nice thing, those black cherries. And we can make cherry bounce out of it, which David does with our black cherries. They're not, names are funny things. Our black cherries are not the black cherries that you read about. Well, that you get, they're not grocery store black cherries. The grocery store black cherries are simply a variety of those big fat cherries. I don't really know what's special about them. I think they're a little different in some way or another. But they're not the same thing. Our black cherries are different, and they have a very distinctive flavor. I love our black cherries. They're really cool. I think they'll make a much better cherry bounce. The black cherries that you get at the grocery store are just kind of sweet and syrupy. Ours actually have a really interesting flavor, which I think is why David's cherry bounce is so good. So David's going to start working on that. Let's see what else we got. Oh, all these wonderful lawn questions, because it's that time of year, isn't it? Listen, folks, let me remind you, raise your lawnmower. Raise your lawnmower. It's the time to do so. If you've got dollar weed, this is the basic thing with dollar weed. If you've got dollar weed and it's in a relatively dry area, you know, it's not along a river, it's not along a stream, it's not in an area that's holding water and that's a bog, you've got dollar weed because you're overwatering. I think it's almost, I never ever see, it just, that's the way it is. And a lot of times the dollar weed may be a small problem in early spring, but as American summer comes on, it will disappear because it really can't stand dry conditions. And the lawn actually prefers drier conditions. So I can help you with the maintenance issues on that. I often say this at the Botanical Gardens, doesn't work in every case, but it often works. Doesn't work every time, but it often works. I simply turned off the irrigation system. There was an irrigation system that was watering shrubs that had just been installed. And the irrigation went on and on and on all summer long, even when the shrubs didn't need it, and certainly when the lawn didn't need it. It was coming on, you know, it was set to come on every other day, basically. We'll come back. We'll talk more about that watering and about dollar weed and all those really not so fun things to talk about. So then we'll get back to talking about really fun things.
It's
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We're in for lots of questions this morning. It's a good time to ask questions. It's the transition season. We're transitioning from spring, well transitioned from spring now, into this season called American summer. And it's still classic American summer. I worry about some changes in the seasons, which we're beginning to see. Our winters are getting much warmer. They are. We get these cold outbreaks, but in general, most days in winter are much warmer, and that makes the cold outbreaks that much worse. You can ask me why if you like. And our summer nights are getting warmer. That's clear. That's not a good thing. But it is very nice that we still have something like American summer left. It may start a little earlier than it used to. It may not last quite as long as it used to. I'm interested to see how that happens. But American summer is here. These are classic American summer conditions throughout the state. I might call it a little something else farther north, but certainly along the Gulf Coast it's called American summer. I would call it that second or third spring. In northernmost Alabama, we got to get a name for this thing. We'll have to think of a good name for this season here. But it's happening, and the nights are cool, the days are warm, sometimes they're hot. You know, it's like you're not used to the heat, so you get out and it's 80 something degrees, and you think, gosh, this feels like 100 degrees because you're not used to it. But you'll get used to it. You will. But the nights are going to cool off very nicely. This is the nice part. And it means a lot of things are going to grow really well this time of year, particularly the kinds of things that you read about in books and magazines that people usually grow in summer. All right. What else we got? So I guess I'm going to be obliged to talk a little bit about lawns. And what can I tell you about lawns? And I think people know that I'm not going to give a prescription for some kind of magic potion. And I just have to say over and over again, there is nothing. If you obsess about your lawn, if you want a really great lawn, you are going to always be disappointed. You're always going to drive yourself absolutely bat crazy. You know, it makes so much more sense to do things like collect stamps. Do something besides obsessing over your lawn. Because it just ain't going to work, because the whole lawn idea is totally flawed. Particularly when it comes to the South, because you can't have the same plant, and I'm sorry I have to repeat this, you can't have the same plant over and over and over, identical plants in every yard, in the city, in your neighborhood, in the city, across the South, and not have huge insect and disease problems. They will always be there. You can hire, they're always going to be a problem. And, you know, you're going to hire Kim Lawn or whoever else, and they're going to come and tell you, oh, we're going to fix this. And then you're going to have a problem, and they're going to say, oh, well, that must be something you did. Or they're going to say, oh, we've got to dethatch now. And then you're going to spend all this money on dethatching, which your lawn doesn't need. It's like bloodletting. It's crazy. I mean, it's an extreme situation when you're getting thatch, and they're causing the thatch themselves. If there is a thatch issue, it's because the Kim Lawn, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use brand names. It's because those folks are promoting it by the way they're fertilizing, and it's just an exceptionally weird thing when that happens, and can only happen when your lawn is being, this is just a cycle, and it's just a cycle of ridiculousness. So I have to, I just have to tell you when you ask me questions about lawns, that it's a cycle of ridiculousness once you get into this obsessive lawn thing. You want something green there. And a lot of times what happens to our lawns are the result of, and we can make things worse by walking on the lawn too much. And this is a real problem in the South, and particularly in wet areas, just walking, the dog walking, the kids walking. All those things are going to create bare spots. And they're going to create bare spots because a lot of our native grasses are, that's not true, a lot of the grasses we use in our lawns simply don't stand up to foot traffic very well. Zoysia does a little better. St. Augustine does not. And I love St. Augustine as a grass to lay on. And it's great for laying on, but it ain't great for playing baseball on or football on, I'll tell you that. So a lot of those problems are about foot. You're not going to solve that problem with a chemical because it's not a pest. The pest is you. The pest is your dog. And so you could get rid of you or the dog, and you might solve the problem. One thing, soil gets compacted too, and there's a lot of reasons it gets compacted. So all that, I just got to say all that. Now, what can you do so that you don't obsess about your lawn? And I'm going to say it's very simple. Don't over-fertilize. I never fertilized my yard. I didn't live in a particularly rich soil area. I never fertilized my yard. I did. That's not true. I did occasionally, and I always ended up with problems as a result. The most important thing you can do in most yards, particularly if they're well established, is to mow correctly and mow as high as possible. And I'm just going to tell you, that solves a tremendous number of problems. If you've got St. Augustine, and if you've got some of the newer kinds of broad-bladed zoysias, you should mow at least 3.5 inches high. But now listen to me. If you mow 4.5 inches high, your lawn's going to be even healthier and have fewer weeds. If you could mow 5 inches high effectively, your lawn's going to be even healthier and have fewer weeds. And there's nothing wrong with mowing 5 inches high. It feels really good. Boy, it feels like you're floating on air. And it's not going to look like it's 5 inches high, except the fact that it's going to look healthy. And it's not going to really, you're not going to have to mow anymore than you mow now. So that's always going to be my best advice. My other piece of advice is don't irrigate all the time. If you've got an irrigation system, you need to use it 3, 4, 5 times a year, and your lawn may benefit. Use it correctly 3, 4, 5 times a year. That means get the lawn wet down to 3 inches deep, at least 3 to 4 inches deep. When it's wet 3 to 4 inches deep, then you turn that sprinkler off and you don't turn it on again until it's dry 3 to 4 inches deep. If you do it that way, you're going to have a lot fewer problems. You're not generally going to have a problem with dollar weed unless you're living in a wetland like on the edge of Dog River. I can't fix that. You chose, you're living in a wetland. And grass is not going to like that conditions. Dollar weed is. And I'm sure you can pay somebody a fortune to try to get rid of the dollar weed, but you're going to be after it all the time. You're going to spend a fortune. And your chemicals are going to go right into Dog River, which surely you had some reason for living on Dog River besides having a lawn there. I don't want to go on. But just something to think about with your lawn, a new way of thinking about your lawn. What can you do that makes it easier to grow lawns? And I say this over and over, for a lot of lawns, particularly where there's heavy foot traffic, particularly where there's shade, particularly where we've seen problems with grass persisting, the simplest and easiest solution at hand, and I will say this over and over again, is going to be monkey grass. And you can mow it, and you will only have to mow it 2 or 3 times a year. You could probably get by mowing it once a year. It's just fine. It works great. That's the best advice I can give you about lawns, all summed up in one 15-minute segment. Here we go.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
That was quick. That was hard. That was fast. So listen, we're back. I didn't mean to rant. I got to say that what I'm telling you about lawns is the best I know about lawns, and I have tried over the years to adjust to the questions that people are asking me about lawns, about how. And at one point I said, you know, I'm going to have a really beautiful lawn, the perfect lawn, so everybody will know how to do it. But then I realized, you know, there ain't no way to have a perfect lawn. Not in the way that people are saying. The perfect lawn is the lawn that's green and that you're happy with. And it may be green with weeds. Who cares? It may not be even grass. Who cares? If it's growing and it's pleasant and it doesn't hurt your feet when you walk on it, who cares? If somebody from the street can't tell it's not grass, who cares? Or that it's not the, you know, whatever grass it was you planted, who cares? Because there's a flawed thing with having a lawn. It's just, that's just the way it is. It's just a flawed idea. And it worked reasonably well in England, where there's no diversity and where there's few pathogens. You see what I'm saying? No, you don't see what I'm saying. The warmer the climate, the more pathogens there are, the more diseases, the more insect pests. You move to a place like England where it's an island, it got creamed by glaciers, there are very few insect pests there. Didn't get creamed by glaciers, it's very cold. And it's still cold. I mean, it's not San Francisco cold in summer, but it's pretty chilly. And so it's not a place where pathogens thrive, and it's not a place where a lot of insect pests thrive. And so that's where we borrowed all this gardening, this lawn stuff from. And then we tried to say, oh, well, I'm going to move to a nearly tropical climate, and I'm going to do that here. Well, what a dumb idea. Just sorry, it's a dumb idea. It ain't going to work. And it won't work for a lot of reasons. You're always going to have problems, and you're always going to have issues, and there's no simple solution to lawn diseases and pests except not to obsess about them. You quit obsessing about them, they're not a problem. No big deal. That's the first step. Second step, don't mow your lawn too close. Now, I went out onto the street and found the first person I could find to testify about this. Steve, you got to come on and testify about this now.
Well, where I was living recently for the past 12 years, yeah, I mean, I was cutting it, you know, 2-3 inches. And I couldn't understand why all the weeds kept coming. I didn't listen to Bill Finch. I should have listened to Bill Finch. I should have mowed that at least 4 inches. And it probably would have been better. So, yeah, if you want weeds, mow it closer down. If you don't want weeds, don't mow it closer down.
Yeah, yeah. And you're still not, no matter what you do, you're still never going to have a perfect, consistent lawn of the same plant over and over again. It's always going to, it just, but why? Why does it matter?
I even thought about turf. Why not just buying, you know, turf and then putting it down? But.
Well, you could, but then the turf is going to die, and it's going to be invaded.
Exactly.
So it's not like don't plow up what you got, thinking you're going to get something better.
Right.
Unless it's monkey grass, which is not a true grass. And right now, it does not have any problems. It seems to work really well. So just something to think about. That's my best advice. Now, I will tell you what I'm looking at in this lawn, and it's hard to see because it's a little fuzzy. There's a nice-looking little dog in the background, and he is not thinking about how to take care of your lawn, and he shouldn't. That's not his business. His business is to run through your yard and wear out the St. Augustine until what looks to me like cucumber weed comes in. You'll see it flowering. If you'll send me a message just telling me whether it's on a vine-like thing, I can tell you whether that it is cucumber weed. You could almost rake it out, particularly in the areas where you've got grass. Just take a hard time rake and you could just about rake it out if that's what it is. The trouble is, what's going to go back there? And that's what we want to try to. That's what we want to try to get to. That's what we want to try to get to. What are we going to grow back with? And in an area with a lot of pressure from people walking, from dogs running, it's going to be hard to get a lot of grasses to grow. I will say zoysia will do a little better there, but I'm making no guarantees if the dog's running over before it can get established. And monkey grass is probably the toughest thing you could find. So Jim is sending me pictures. I'm not sure there's a question. Yes, so there is a question. The questions aren't necessarily. I went to the country and found this blooming on my walk along a trip to Chickasaw Hay. Oh, I love the Chickasaw Hay, that bloody river. It is a beautiful bloody river. Have you seen it? You know, now there's so much sediment going into it sometimes that it's hard to see. But in the old days, there would be times when you could see the water was just blood red from all those springs on the upper part of the Chickasaw. Just a beautiful color. Well, that beautiful flower that you're looking at is anise, Florida anise. Coastal anise, Gulf Coastal anise, Deep South anise, whatever we want to call it. It is the coolest plant. Anise Elysium, the genus, is one of the oldest flowering plants around that's still extant. It is a relic from the earliest days, and it says something about how old our southern flora is, that we actually have many species of Elysium here. In the south, or at least two or three, it's a really cool flower, and the flower is the leaves have a real incredible fragrance, and that's one way to always tell, Jim, is just crush those leaves, and you know that anise scent, and it'll stay on your hands. It's such a strong oil. The flowers, which that's a beautiful flower and a nice big specimen, the flowers have a very different smell, which you stick your nose up to and tell me what you smell. Everybody has different ways of perceiving that smell. I actually find it's kind of it's an interesting smell. Some people say it smells like fish. And, you know, I got it. There is a little bit of that, but it's actually fish in the way that people sometimes smell a fish. it's a very human smell to me. And not necessarily a sweet smell, but a musky human smell. Very interesting. But it attracts insects that like that smell. And those may be hoverflies, they may be a lot of other different things. And they do the pollination. It's an ancient plant. Your other picture, and this is so much more fun to talk about, isn't it? Your other picture is a beech tree. Yes, we see beech trees growing very far south, and that's exactly what it is. You'll see beech nuts around that tree, which are kind of cool things. They're a little hard to process, but they, you know, they're actually can make pretty good food. All right. Have I been seeing some dogwoods blooming? Well, surely, you know, I think dogwoods are not doing as well on the deep coast as they do farther north. And so we've lost a lot of dogwoods. If you want to go to the Red Hills, however, the dogwoods are still great. They're doing very well, and you'll see a lot of them blooming. Why do we have problems with dogwoods? For the same reason we have problems with lawns. And I said this last week. I'll have to say it again. We have problems with dogwoods. There are many reasons we had problems with dogwoods. But the primary reason is we planted them ear to ear to ear to ear. We planted them everywhere. And then we started bringing in dogwoods from other places that had disease. And it was like, boom, it was like nursery school. It just spread through all the trees. And now we have multiple diseases affecting our dogwoods on the Gulf Coast, and that's a huge problem. And what's the remedy? Well, it's not to plant more dogwoods. And right now, we haven't found a dogwood that does really well along the deep Gulf Coast. They're all going to have issues. But as you move farther into the interior, they're better. Monroe County, Clark County on up, they're doing much better. All right, we're going to be back here in just a minute.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Now, I love this kind of text. This is the kind of information you can use. This is great information. In the early days, the text reads, Hank Williams also played in Camden, probably as much as Greenville. Please don't leave Wilkes County out of Hank's whippoorwill possibilities. I would be wrong to do that. I would be so wrong to do that. I can see him playing all these little roadhouses up and down 31 in the old days. That was the way we got from Mobile to Birmingham in the old days before we had that monstrosity running down the middle of the state. And so all those little roadhouses on 31, that was that. Yeah, I'm sure he played them. But I also like the idea that he played in Camden and Wilkes County and at some of the roadhouses there. Do we know where he played in Wilkes County? Now, that's a really, really good question. And did he play in Pineapple? These are good questions. These are important questions. That's the kind of questions we should be answering. So, yeah, you know, when I think he heard, and so it's very interesting. So if you're in Wilkes County, I should do this again. Steve says that I should go on. What's that show, Steve? You've Got Talent, or Talent's You, or Who is Talent? What's that show, Steve? You've Got Talent, right? Oh, Steve's not helping. So it's Steve thinks I should go on that show, and with my whippoorwill call. But
yes,
what's the name of the show? Is it You've Got Talent?
America's Got Talent. Yeah.
America's Got Talent. That's what it is. Sorry. And, or, you know, wherever it is, it's got talent. So, Alabama's Got Talent. We should have. So, there's this great guy the other day. He did great quail calls. And I'm thinking, God, I wish I could do that. It was beautiful. It was the most beautiful quail. All the different sounds that quails make. And there's a bunch of them. And he was doing all of them. It was the coolest thing I've ever. And I'm thinking, you know, in my next life, I'm going to be able to do quail calls just like that. That's what I'm going to live for. But so here's the whippoorwill call. If I got to get my lips in shape here. And there's a bird singing outside, so don't pay attention to that. Now that's the whippoorwill. But listen to this. This is different. That's a slightly different sound, and that's what I hear when I hear the southern whippoorwill. And there's, you know, there's some other notes in there, but that's kind of what I hear coming to my ear. And it's interesting to listen to. It's not that straight whippoorwill sound. And I think that's what Hank Williams heard, if he was listening. And I think he was. He's from Greenville. Or just outside of Greenville. What's that little town? Somebody's going to get mad that I didn't remember the town. But it's not Chapman, is it? Maybe it is Chapman. So there, yes. So in Camden, Journey's End and Camden's Movie Theater, when they entertain live shows. So this is really interesting. Good news. This is good to hear. And isn't it too bad that we don't have those kinds of venues in our small towns anymore? Every small town's ambition is to be a suburb of some big town. Isn't that pitiful? Isn't that sad? And so none of them really have their own center anymore. People are going to go listen to music. They're going to listen on the internet, I guess. Or if they're going to do a live show, they're going to drive to wherever, Huntsville or whatever. But wasn't it cool back when Camden, I mean, there were some bad old things that went on in Camden in the old days. I don't mean to glorify the old days too much, but wasn't it cool when we had our own music venues in those towns? Just things to think about. All right. So David Hubble. David and I always have great conversations, and he's always tantalizing me with food during the show. I used some of last year's okra to make an old-style okra gumbo with chicken in it. No celery or bell peppers. And, you know, David, I think about you every time I use celery because David and I talk about it so much. And I am the one who says you don't need celery to make everything. And celery, there's nothing sacred about celery. And celery is actually not a very southern thing at all. And certainly not a New Orleans thing. And if you're thinking that traditional gumbo was made with celery, I think you're not thinking very well. I don't even think traditional gumbo is made with bell peppers. Now, there's nothing wrong with using bell peppers and nothing wrong with using celery, and I use both when I don't have better things to use. Celery's just fine. It's actually kind of good. I see the benefits of it, but there's other things to use that are kind of cool. I used fennel the other day instead of celery. It was in the lentils, and it really amped it up a lot. And fennel is a lot easier to grow for us than celery, and I think it's pretty cool. Pretty cool crop, and really great with fish. I love fennel. All right. Jim is saying, thanks for the Annis Beach answer. Ligustrum is at the top of my list. What is about this so appealing? Good show. You know, I don't think we need any of the ligustrums. They're all unreliable in various ways, and none of them are very pleasant. We don't need to be planting them anymore. Bobby Green may disagree with me. He has disagreed with me about Japanese ligustrum, which is an okay plant, but, you know, it's really hard to distinguish from the invasive waxleaf ligustrum. And I don't see that it just adds a whole lot to have it. So, yeah, it's sad. It's sad. I think, let's don't get started on that. We're having a fun time thinking about lots of fun things. Man, that train was winding low. So, you know, it's fun to think about. It is fun to think about old Hank Aaron and where he was and what he was listening to when he wrote some of those songs. Kalijah, you know, where was that? Where did he see that? I was 100 yards away in Baltimore. And so that was about 11 years ago. Keith is telling me about, I think he's telling me about when he was listening to the cicadas in Baltimore and that his ears rang for 2 weeks. And I was about 100 yards away. I was about 100 yards away when I first noticed them. It was up around Franklin in Alabama, these cicadas, this big hatch out, this 13-year hatch out that occurred if I remember correctly, in 2011, and I was driving along the road on Franklin, and for some reason I had stopped, and there's a road down to a church. I remember this vividly, and I could hear them through the car. I was unfortunately having to drive. I hate driving. But, you know, it gets you places sometimes. And I could hear it through the windows. I did, had the windows up, and I could hear it, and I just stopped, and I pulled in there, and I looked, and I listened, and it was amazing. It was amazing. And it was, you know, to say it was 100 yards away is not fair. There was 100 yards down to the church, and the whole road was lined with it, just lined with the sounds. And I stopped and looked at them. They were so amazing. I remember that vividly. Because they were so different than the regular cicadas, and they start a little earlier, and the sound is very different. So that's it. They're going to be happening. If you're in the right place, you're going to see them. There it is. Let's see. Yes, I have a bird app. And what I'm hearing is Chuck Will's widow. Not whippoorwill. That's right. And it is. So Chuck Will's widow, I don't really like the name Chuck Will's widow. It's just my fault, I guess. I don't understand Chuck Will's widow at all. But it's the southern whippoorwill. It's the whippoorwill that is sort of classic down south. The northern whippoorwill, which has that, you know, whippoorwill sound, that you're going to see in the northernmost part of the state, north of Birmingham, but I think you're rarely going to hear it south of Birmingham. I'm not saying you'll never hear it, but it's going to be rare. Mostly what we hear is the southern whippoorwill, which I think has a far more interesting sound. Something like that. Any rate, there it is. And you can use your bird apps, or you can use straight from my lips. There it is. Good. I sauteed some tender Smilax tops with onions and broccoli. Absolutely delicious. Thanks for the info, Wayne. Yeah, we forget about all these things, and I always should remind you, the Smilax is delicious this time of year. Smilax Smallii is the best. I'm going to try some other Smilax this year, some of the herbaceous Smilax, and see how it tastes. It's really beginning to elongate. It's not as thick, but I'm going to try some of that this year. But Smilax Smallii is just great. It's what do we call it? What's the name of it? There's an old name for it. But it's the Smilax that doesn't have any thorns on it. Smilax is greenbrier, sawbrier. And I give you all those names, but there are some that don't have thorns on them, and they have these really beautiful leaves, and we actually use them for decoration around houses. And they have the most beautiful, tasty spears, and you can mix them up, and I would never tell my mother that I did this. But one Easter, I actually served her Smilax. Now, my mother thought that you never ate anything if it didn't come from the Jitney Jungle or the Dell Champs. But you know what? Smilax is delicious. It's really delicious. And really a nice plant. Nice thing to eat. All right, so what else we got? Ennis Beach, good. So we're about caught up with our questions. Oh boy, that was such a fun digression on Hank Aaron's. If I've missed something, you call me back. Jim says, "Dear, totally agree with your Smilax assessment," and it's true. Particularly if they're high protein, you know, hunters are so interesting. They get all their information from some magazine written in Minnesota, and they take it as some sort of weird gospel, like the guys who write, you know. And you know, if you wanted deer food for winter, what you would do is you'd take a patch of Smilax and you'd fertilize it. You wouldn't worry about all this other yankety yank stuff that you're doing. And Sean, go ahead and shoot me. Shoot me, Sean. Smilax, it's the, I dear love it. They are crazy for it.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Jesse in Satsuma, two interesting questions. The first is it too late for corn? And I'd have to say, you're getting into the pest season on the Gulf Coast, and it's a little harder to grow corn. You're going to see greater pest problems. It is probably not too late. Fall crops of corn are hit or miss for a variety of reasons, but you could certainly try. I do know that a lot of Native tribes and probably Native First Nations, like the Choctaws, probably planted their two crops of corn a year. But I don't know how late in the year, and climate may have been a little bit different back then. It's a great question. You tell me how you do planting it, but you're going to have a little more problem with pests. Is there a great place? This is Jesse. I got to know, why do you want convict caterpillars? I'm not opposed to that. I just think it's fascinating that you want to grow convict caterpillars, and I got to know why. It's so cool. You got to tell me. You got to message me and tell me next week, or you got to call me and tell me why you're growing convict caterpillars. He wants to know what he can grow them on and where he can get the seeds. I doubt you can find the plants. I doubt anybody's selling them. If you can get to the Delta and you can find the seeds on Hymenocallis, our beautiful Delta lilies that are blooming probably about a week or two ago they peaked, but they're probably still blooming. Get the seeds from them. The seeds are really easy to start, and I guarantee you those convict caterpillars love those guys. They like crinum lilies too, and they're really easy to grow from seed. But we'll talk more about that next week. We have a caller, Steve. What an amazing thing to see that we actually have a phone caller. I'm listening. Who is it? Hey, anybody there? Well, Steve, we got anybody on the phone?
Not at this point, no.
Anybody there?
No.
What, phone? Have we got somebody on the phone?
No, sir.
Ah, I am so sorry. So we missed that. And we missed that, so I'm not sure what that was about. Sorry I missed that call. Back to Jesse, and I wish I knew why Jesse wants to grow convict caterpillars. So convict caterpillars are a type of caterpillar. The moth is really cool, and I, you know, maybe Jesse just likes the moth. Maybe he just likes to look at it. I'm not sure what the deal is, but the moth is quite pretty. It's very interesting. Those convict caterpillars are striped. They're black and white. That's why they're called convict caterpillars. They look like the old, you know, 1930s movies of the uniforms that they made prisoners wear. Black and white stripes. And so they will just decimate. I mean, decimate's probably the right word. Hymenocallis and other things in the Delta. There's some of the major herbivores in the Delta. A lot of times the big lubber grasshoppers don't leave a lot of those left over for the convict caterpillars. So it's kind of hit or miss sometimes is that the other great herbivore, those lubber caterpillars, really get the Hymenocallis first. But our native amaryllis, and we've got a lot of them in that group, not like traditional lilies, but more like rain lilies and the Delta lilies, the Hymenocallis, and the spider lilies, what we call the Delta spider lilies, those white spider lilies of the Delta, not the red spider lilies, but they're all sort of this amaryllis group. But lycoris are more closely related to them too, which is the red spider lilies. And sometimes, well, the leaves aren't out at the right time for them to get eaten by convict caterpillars. But certainly you will see things like narcissus, convict caterpillars will eat. But there it is. Oh, goodness. So is Jackie there? Are we going to have time? Let's try Jackie. I'm listening.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. I have a question about pecan trees.
Yes, ma'am.
I live in South Mobile County, all very close to Bellengrave Gardens. And I was told that it takes a certain type of pecan to do well in the wet soil in that area. Can you tell me what kind that is?
No, I can't. I am not familiar with pecans. Pecans are usually, okay, most pecans are actually native to floodplains. So they're more tolerant than a lot of trees to wet soils, but they're not necessarily going to be more productive in those areas. I think the bigger problem with down there is going to be the wind. I guess, and depending on where you are, I think your disease problems, and if you've got soils that are suitable for pecans that aren't too wet, you don't want it to be sopping wet. Is your soil dry or wet?
It's dry right now because of the wind, but it's normally a moist area.
Yeah. Is it a low area?
Well, I'm not in a floodplain, no, but it is a low area.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the soil is going to be that limiting. It may be more likely that the pecan gets blown over during a hurricane than if it were on drier soils.
So any kind should produce.
No, because you're going to want one that's very disease resistant. So what you're really going to want, if you want a pecan, is to get one that is extremely disease resistant. They all have problems right now, and particularly that far south, and none of them are going to be perfect. But generally, the pecans, you probably want a shorter pecan. You want a pecan that's not going to get as big as the old ones like Stewart and some of the others. You want a shorter pecan, and they're generally going to have names of Indian tribes. And there's a bunch of them out there, and you'll probably need two varieties that have the names of these Indian tribes. I'm not going to make a recommendation on which I think is best, because not sure I really know which is best. I haven't tried them all. But
right.
look for those. Look for the ones that are disease resistant, that are a little more dwarf, because if you don't want one that's going to get big, because you got hurricanes and you've got winds, and pecans are very brittle. They are not native to the Gulf Coast. They're native farther inland. They really don't tolerate those high winds very well at all. So those are the two things I'd worry about the most. And if the soil is reasonably dry right now, it should be fine.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Down south, how the weather in the delta, how the food tastes in your mouth.